The Fifth Night. Mr. Jabal. Sir, when you get here, you'll be told we Indians invented everything from the internet to hard-boiled eggs to spaceships before the British stole it all from us. Nonsense. The greatest thing to come out of this country in the 10,000 years of its history is the rooster coop. Go to Old Delhi, behind the Jama Masjid, and look at the way they keep chickens there in the market. Hundreds of pale hens and brightly coloured roosters, stuffed tightly into wire mesh cages, packed as tightly as worms in a belly, pecking each other and shitting on each other, jostling just for breathing space. The whole cage giving off a horrible stench, the stench of terrified, feathered flesh. On the wooden desk above this coop sits a grinning young butcher, showing off the flesh and organs of a recently chopped-up chicken, still oleaginous with a coating of dark blood. The roosters in the coop smell the blood from above. They see the organs of their brothers lying around them. They know they're next, yet they do not rebel. They do not try to get out of the coop. The very same thing is done with human beings in this country. Watch the roads in the evenings in Delhi. Sooner or later you will see a man on a cycle rickshaw pedaling down the road with a giant bed or a table tied to the cart that is attached to his cycle. Every day, furniture is delivered to people's homes by this man, the delivery man. A bed costs 5,000 rupees, maybe 6,000. Add the chairs and a coffee table, and it's 10 or 15,000. A man comes on a cycle cart, bringing you this bed, table and chairs. A poor man, who may make 500 rupees a month. He unloads all this furniture for you, and you give him the money in cash. A fat wad of cash, the size of a brick. He puts it into his pocket, or into his shirt, or into his underwear, and cycles back to his boss and hands it over without touching a single rupee of it. A year's salary, 2 years' salary, in his hands, and he never takes a rupee of it. Every day on the roads of Delhi, some chauffeur is driving an empty car with a black suitcase sitting on the back seat. Inside that suitcase is 1 million, 2 million rupees. More money than that chauffeur will see in his lifetime. If he took the money, he could go to America, Australia, anywhere and start a new life. He could go inside the 5-star hotels he has dreamed about all his life and only seen from the outside. He could take his family to Goa, to England. Yet he takes that black suitcase where his master wants. He puts it down where he is meant to, and never touches a rupee. Why? Because Indians are the world's most honest people, like the Prime Minister's booklet will inform you? No. It's because 99.9% of us are caught in the rooster coop, just like those poor guys in the poultry market. The rooster coop doesn't always work with minuscule sums of money. Don't test your chauffeur with a rupee coin or two. He may well steal that much, but leave $1 million in front of a servant and he won't touch a penny. Try it. Leave a black bag with $1 million in a Mumbai taxi. The taxi driver will call the police and return the money by the day's end. I guarantee it. Whether the police will give it to you or not is another story, sir. Masters trust their servants with diamonds in this country. It's true. Every evening on the train out of Surat, where they run the world's biggest diamond cutting and polishing business, the servants of diamond merchants are carrying suitcases full of cut diamonds that they have to give to someone in Mumbai. Why doesn't that servant take the suitcase full of diamonds? He's no Gandhi. He's human. He's you and me. But he's in the rooster coop. The trustworthiness of servants is the basis of the entire Indian economy. The great Indian rooster coop. Do you have something like it in China too? I doubt it, Mr. Jabal. Or you wouldn't need the Communist Party to shoot people, and the secret police to raid their houses at night and put them in jail like I've heard you have over there. Here in India we have no dictatorship, no secret police. That's because we have the coop. Never before in human history have so few owed so much to so many, Mr. Jabal. A handful of men in this country have trained the remaining 99.9%, as strong, as talented, as intelligent in every way, to exist in perpetual servitude. A servitude so strong that you can put the key of his emancipation in a man's hands, and he will throw it back at you with a curse. You will have to come here and see it for yourself to believe it. Every day, millions wake up at dawn, stand in dirty, crowded buses, get off at their master's posh houses, and then clean the floors, wash the dishes, weed the garden, feed their children, press their feet, all for a pittance. I will never envy the rich of America or England, Mr. Jabal. They have no servants there. They cannot even begin to understand what a good life is. Now, a thinking man like you, Mr. Premier, must ask two questions. Why does the rooster coop work? How does it trap so many millions of men and women so effectively? Secondly, can a man break out of the coop? What if one day, for instance, a driver took his employer's money and ran? What would his life be like? I will answer both for you, sir. The answer to the first question is that the pride and glory of our nation, the repository of all our love and sacrifice, the subject of no doubt considerable space in the pamphlet that the Prime Minister will hand over to you, the Indian family, is the reason we are trapped and tied to the coop. The answer to the second question is that only a man who is prepared to see his family destroyed, hunted, beaten, and burned alive by the masters can break out of the coop. That would take no normal human being, but a freak, a pervert of nature. It would, in fact, take a white tiger. You are listening to the story of a social entrepreneur, sir. To go back to my story, there is a sign in the National Zoo in New Delhi, near the cage with the white tiger, which says, "Imagine yourself in the cage." When I saw that sign, I thought, I can do that. I can do that with no trouble at all. For a whole day I was down there in my dingy room, my legs pulled up to my chest, sitting inside that mosquito net, too frightened to leave the room. No one asked me to drive the car. No one came down to see me. My life had been written away. I was to go to jail for a killing I had not done. I was in terror, and yet not once did the thought of running away cross my mind. Not once did the thought, "I'll tell the judge the truth," cross my mind. I was trapped in the rooster coop. What would jail be like? That was all I could think about. What kind of strategies would I follow to escape the big, hairy, dirty men I would find in there? I remembered a story from Murder Weekly, in which a man sent to jail pretended to have AIDS so that no one would bugger him. Where was that copy of the magazine? If only I had it with me now, I could copy his exact words, his exact gestures. But if I said I had AIDS, would they assume I was a professional bugger, and bugger me even more? I was trapped. Through the perforations of my net, I sat staring at the impressions of the anonymous hand that had applied the white plaster to the walls of the room. "Country Mouse!" Vitiligo lips had come to the threshold of my room. "Your boss is ringing the bell like crazy." I put my head on the pillow. He came into the room and pressed his black face and pink lips against the net. "Country Mouse, are you ill? Is it typhoid? Cholera? Dengue?" I shook my head. "I'm fine." "Good to hear that." With a big smile of his diseased lips, he left. I went up, like a man to his hanging, up the stairs and into the apartment building, and then up the elevator to the 13th floor. The mongoose opened the door. There was no smile on his face this time, not a hint of what he had planned for me. "You took your time coming. Father is here. He wants to have a word with you." My heart raced. The stork was here. He would save me. He wasn't useless, like his two sons. He was an old-fashioned master. He knew he had to protect his servants. He was on the sofa, with his pale legs stretched out. As soon as he saw me, his face broke open in a big smile, and I thought, he's smiling because he saved me. But the old landlord wasn't thinking of me at all. Oh no, he was thinking of things far more important than my life. He pointed to those two important things. Ah, Balram, my feet really need a good massage. It was a long trip by train. My hand shook as it turned on the hot water faucet in the bathroom. The water hit the bottom of the bucket and splashed all over my legs, and when I looked down, I saw that they were almost rattling. A trickle of urine was running down them. A minute later, a big smile on my face, I came to where the stork was sitting and placed the bucket of hot water near him. "Put your feet in, sir." "Oh," he said, and closed his eyes. His lips parted, and he began to make little moans, sir, and the sound of those moans drove me to press his feet harder and harder. My body began rocking as I did so, and my head knocked the sides of his knees. The mongoose and Mr. Ashok were sitting in front of a TV screen, playing a computer game together. The door to the bedroom opened, and Pinky Madam came out. She had no makeup on, and her face was a mess. Black skin under her eyes, lines on her forehead. The moment she saw me, she got excited. "Have you people told the driver?" The stork said nothing. Mr. Ashok and the mongoose kept playing the game. "Has no one told him? What a fucking joke! He's the one who was going to go to jail?" Mr. Ashok said, "I suppose we should tell him." He looked at his brother, who kept his eyes on the TV screen. The mongoose said, "Fine." Mr. Ashok turned to me. "We have a contact in the police. He's told us that no one has reported seeing the accident, so your help won't be needed, Balram." I felt such tremendous relief that I moved my hand abruptly, and the bucket of warm water spilled over, and then I scrambled to put the bucket upright. The stork opened his eyes, smacked me on the head with his hand, and then closed his eyes. Pinky Madam watched. Her face changed. She ran into her room and slammed the door. "Who would have thought, Mr. Jabbaw, that of this whole family, the lady with the short skirt would be the one with a conscience?" The stork watched her go into her room and said, "She's gone crazy, that woman, wanting to find the family of the child and give them compensation. Craziness! As if we were all murderers here!" He looked sternly at Mr. Ashok. "You need to control that wife of yours better, son. The way we do it in the village." Then he gave me a light tap on the head and said, "The water's gone cold." I massaged his feet every morning for the next 3 days. One morning he had a little pain in his stomach, so the mongoose made me drive him down to Max, which is one of Delhi's most famous private hospitals. I stood outside and watched as the mongoose and the old man went inside the beautiful big glass building. Doctors walked in and out with long white coats and stethoscopes in their pockets. When I peeped in from outside, the hospital's lobby looked as clean as the inside of a 5-star hotel. The day after the hospital trip, I drove the stork and the mongoose down to the railway station, bought them the snacks they would need for their trip home, waited for the train to leave, and then drove the car back, wiped it down, went to a nearby Hanuman temple to say a prayer of thanks, came back to my room and fell inside the mosquito net, dead tired. When I woke up, someone was standing in my room, turning the lights on and off. It was Pinky Madam. "Get ready. You're going to drive me." "Yes, madam," I said, rubbing my eyes. "What time is it?" She put a finger to her lips. I put on a shirt and then got the car out and drove it to the front of the building. She had a bag in her hand. "Where to?" I asked. It was 2 in the morning. She told me, and I asked, "Isn't sir coming?" "Just drive." I drove her to the airport. I asked no questions. When she got out at the airport, she pushed a brown envelope into my window, then slammed her door and left. And that was how, Your Excellency, my employer's marriage came to an end. Other drivers have techniques to prolong the marriages of their masters. One of them told me that whenever the fighting got worse, he drove fast so they would get home quickly. Whenever they got romantic, he let the car slow down. If they were shouting at each other, he asked them for directions. If they were kissing, he turned the music up. I feel some part of the responsibility falls on me that their marriage broke up while I was the driver. The following morning, Mr. Ashok called me to the apartment. When I knocked on the door, he caught me by the collar of my shirt and pulled me inside. "Why didn't you tell me?" he said, tightening his hold on the collar, almost choking me. "Why didn't you wake me up at once?"
"Sir," she said...
He grabbed me and pushed me against the balcony of the apartment. The landlord inside him wasn't dead after all. "Why did you drive her there, sister fucker?" I turned my head. Behind me, I saw all the shiny towers and shopping malls of Gurgaon. "Did you want to ruin my family's reputation?" He pushed me harder against the balcony. My head and chest were over the edge now. And if he pushed me even a bit more, I was in real danger of flying over. I gathered my legs and kicked him in the chest. He staggered back and hit the sliding glass door between the house and the balcony. I slid down against the edge of the balcony. He sat down against the glass door. The two of us were panting.
"You can't blame me, sir,"
I shouted. "I'd never heard of a woman's leaving her husband for good. I mean, yes, on TV, but not in real life. I just did what she told me to." A crow sat down on the balcony and cawed. Both of us turned and stared at it. Then his madness was over. He covered his face in his hands and began to sob. I ran down to my room. I got into the mosquito net and sat on the bed. I counted to 10 to make sure he hadn't followed me. Then, reaching under the bed, I took out the brown envelope and opened it again. It was full of 100 rupee notes. 47 of them. I shoved the envelope under the bed. Someone was coming toward my room. 4 of the drivers walked in.
"Tell us about it, Country Mouse."
They took positions around me.
"Tell you what?" "The gatekeeper spilled the beans. There are no secrets around here. You drove the woman somewhere at night and came back alone."
"Has she left him?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"We know they've been fighting, Country Mouse. And you drove her somewhere at night."
"The airport?
She's gone, isn't she? It's a divorce. Every rich man these days is divorcing his wife.
These rich people..."
He shook his head, his lips curled up in scorn, exposing his reddish, rotting, pan-decayed canines. "No respect for God, for marriage, family, nothing. She just went out for some fresh air, and I brought her back. That gatekeeper has gone blind.
Loyal to the last.
They don't make servants like you anymore." I waited all morning for the bell to ring, but it did not. In the afternoon, I went up to the 13th floor and rang the bell and waited. He opened his door and his eyes were red.
"What is it?"
"Nothing, sir. I came to make lunch."
"No need for that.
I thought he was going to apologize for almost killing me, but he said nothing about it."
"Sir, you must eat. It's not good for your health to starve. Please, sir."
With a sigh, he let me in. Now that she was gone, I knew that it was my duty to be like a wife to him. I had to make sure he ate well and slept well and did not get thin. I made lunch, I served him, I cleaned up. Then I went down and waited for the bell. At 8 o'clock, I took the elevator up again. Pressing my ear against the door, I listened. Nothing. Not a sound. I rang the bell. No response. I knew he couldn't be out. I was his driver, after all. Where could he go without me? The door was open. I walked in. He lay beneath the framed photo of the 2 Pomeranians, a bottle on the mahogany table in front of him, his eyes closed. I sniffed the bottle. Whiskey. Almost all of it gone. I put it to my lips and emptied the dregs.
"Sir,"
I said, but he did not wake up. I gave him a push. I slapped him on the face. He licked his lips, sucked his teeth. He was waking up, but I slapped him a second time anyway. A time-honored servant's tradition, slapping the master when he's asleep, like jumping on pillows when masters are not around, or urinating into their plants, or beating or kicking their pet dogs. Innocent servants' pleasures. I dragged him into his bedroom, pulled the blanket over him,
turned the lights off and went down. There was going to be no driving tonight, so I headed off to the Action English Liquor Shop. My nose was still full of Mr. Ashok's whiskey. The same thing happened the next night, too. The third night he was drunk, but awake.
"Drive me," he said, "anywhere you want, to the malls, to the hotels, anywhere."
Around and around the shiny malls and hotels of Gurgaon I drove him, and he sat slouched in the back seat, not even talking on the phone for once. When the master's life is in chaos, so is the servant's. I thought, maybe he's sick of Delhi now. Will he go back to Dhanbad? What happens to me then? My belly churned. I thought I would crap right there on my seat, on the gearbox.
"Stop the car," he said.
He opened the door of the car, put his hand on his stomach, bent down and threw up on the ground. I wiped his mouth with my hand and helped him sit by the side of the road. The traffic roared past us. I patted his back.
"You're drinking too much, sir." "Why do men drink, Balram?"
"I don't know, sir."
"Of course, in your caste you don't. Let me tell you, Balram, men drink because they are sick of life. I thought caste and religion didn't matter any longer in today's world. My father said, 'No, don't marry her. She's of another... I..."
Mr. Ashok turned his head to the side, and I rubbed his back, thinking he might throw up again, but the spasm passed.
"Sometimes I wonder, Balram. I wonder what's the point of living. I really wonder."
"The point of living?" My heart pounded. "The point of your living is that if you die, who's going to pay me 3,500 rupees a month?"
"You must believe in God, sir. You must go on. My granny says that if you believe in God, then good things will happen." "That's true. It's true. We must believe," he sobbed. "Once there was a man who stopped believing in God, and you know what happened?"
"What?"
"His buffalo died at once."
"I see," he laughed. "I see." "Yes, sir, it really happened. The next day he said, 'God, I'm sorry, I believe in you.' And guess what happened?"
"His buffalo came back to life?"
"Exactly." He laughed again. I told him another story, and this made him laugh some more. Has there ever been a master-servant relationship like this one? He was so powerless, so lost, my heart just had to melt. Whatever anger I had against him for trying to pin Pinky Madam's hit-and-run killing on me passed away that evening. That was her fault. Mr. Ashok had nothing to do with it. I forgave him entirely. I talked to him about the wisdom of my village, half repeating things I remembered Granny saying, and half making things up on the spot, and he nodded. It was a scene to put you in mind of that passage in the Bhagavad Gita when our Lord Krishna, another of history's famous chauffeurs, stops the chariot he is driving and gives his passenger some excellent advice on life and death. Like Krishna, I philosophized, I joked, I even sang a song, all to make Mr. Ashok feel better. Baby, I thought, rubbing his back as he heaved and threw up one more time, you big pathetic baby. I put my hand out and wiped the vomit from his lips and cooed soothing words to him. It squeezed my heart to see him suffer like this. But where my genuine concern for him ended and where my self-interest began, I could not tell. No servant can ever tell what the motives of his heart are. Do we loathe our masters behind a facade of love? Or do we love them behind a facade of loathing? We are made mysteries to ourselves by the rooster coop we are locked in. The next day I went to a roadside temple in Gurgaon. I put a rupee before the two resident pairs of divine asses and prayed that Pinky Madam and Mr. Ashok should be reunited and given a long and happy life together in Delhi. A week passed like this, and then the mongoose turned up from Dhanbad, and Mr. Ashok and I went together to the station to collect him. The moment he arrived, everything changed for me. The intimacy was over between me and Mr. Ashok. Once again I was only the driver. Once again I was only the eavesdropper. I spoke to her last night. She's not coming back to India. Her parents are happy with her decision. This can end only one way. Don't worry about it, Ashok. It's okay. And don't call her again. I'll handle it from Dhanbad. If she makes any noise about wanting your money, I'll just gently bring up that matter of the hit and run. See? It's not the money I'm worried about, Mukesh. I know. I know. The mongoose put his hand on Mr. Ashok's shoulder, just the way Kishan had put his hand on my shoulders so many times. We were driving past a slum, one of those series of makeshift tents, where the workers at some construction site were living. The mongoose was saying something, but Mr. Ashok wasn't paying attention. He was looking out the window. My eyes obeyed his eyes. I saw the silhouettes of the slum dwellers close to one another inside the tents. You could make out one family, a husband, a wife, a child, all huddled around a stove inside one tent, lit up by a golden lamp. The intimacy seemed so complete, so crushingly complete. I understood what Mr. Ashok was going through. He lifted his hand. I prepared for his touch, but he wrapped it around the mongoose's shoulder. When I was in America, I thought family was a burden. I don't deny it. When you and father tried to stop me from marrying Pinky because she wasn't a Hindu, I was furious with you. I don't deny it. But without a family, a man is nothing. Absolutely nothing. I had nothing but the driver in front of me for 5 nights. Now at last I have someone real by my side. You. I went up to the apartment with them. The Mongols wanted me to make a meal for them. And I made a dal and chapatis and a dish of okra. I served them and then I cleaned the utensils and plates. During dinner, the Mongols said, "If you're getting depressed, Ashok, why don't you try yoga and meditation? There's a yoga master on TV and he's very good. This is what he does every morning on his program." He closed his eyes, breathed in, and then exhaled slowly, saying, "Om." When I came out of the kitchen, wiping my hands on the sides of my pants, the mongoose said, "Wait." He took a piece of paper from his pocket and dangled it with a big grin, as if it were a prize for me. "You have a letter from your granny. What is her name?" He began to cut the letter open with a thick black finger. "Kusum, sir." "Remarkable woman," he said, and rubbed his forearms up and down. I said, "Sir, don't bother yourself. I can read." He cut the letter open. He began reading it aloud. Mr. Ashok spoke in English, and I guessed what he said. "Doesn't he have the right to read his own letters?" And his brother replied in English, and again I guessed, rather than understood, his meaning. "He won't mind a thing like this. He has no sense of privacy. In the villages there are no separate rooms, so they just lie together at night and fuck like that. Trust me, he doesn't mind." He turned so that the light was behind him and began to read aloud. "Dear grandson, this is being written by Mr. Krishna, the school teacher. He remembers you fondly and refers to you by your old nickname, the White Tiger. Life has become hard here. The rains have failed. Can you ask your employer for some money for your family? And remember to send the money home." The mongoose put the letter down. "That's all these servants want. Money, money, money. They're called your servants, but they suck the lifeblood out of you, don't they?" He continued reading the letter. "With your brother Kishan, I said, now is the time. And he did it. He married. With you, I do not order. You are different from all the others. You are deep, like your mother. Even as a boy, you were so. When you would stop near the pond and stare at the black fort with your mouth open in the morning and evening and night. So I do not order you to marry, but I tempt you with the joys of married life. It is good for the community. Every time there is a marriage, there is more rain in the village. The water buffalo will get fatter. It will give more milk. These are known facts. We are all so proud of you, being in the city. But you must stop thinking only about yourself and think about us too. First, you must visit us and eat my chicken curry. Your loving granny Kusum." The mongoose was about to give me the letter, but Mr. Ashok took it from him and read it again. "Sometimes they express themselves so movingly, these villagers," he said, before flinging the letter on the table for me to pick up. In the morning I drove the mongoose to the railway station, and got him his favourite snack, the dosa, once again, from which I removed the potatoes, flinging them on the tracks before handing it over to him. I got down onto the platform and waited. He chomped on the dosa in his seat. Down below on the tracks, a mouse nibbled on the discarded potatoes. I drove back to the apartment block. I took the elevator to the 13th floor. The door was open.
"Sir!" I shouted when I saw what was going on in the living room. "Sir, this is madness!"
He had put his feet in a plastic bucket and was massaging them himself.
"You should have told me. I would have massaged you," I shouted, and reached down to his feet. He shrieked, "No!" I said, "Yes, sir, you must. I'm failing in my duty if I let you do it yourself," and forced my hands into the dirty water in the bucket and squeezed his feet. "No!"
Mr. Asher kicked the bucket, and the water spilled all over the floor.
"How stupid can you people get?"
He pointed to the door. "Get out.
Can you leave me alone for just 5 minutes in a day? Do you think you can manage that?"
That evening I had to drive him to the mall again. I stayed inside the car after he got out. I did not mix with any of the other drivers. Even at night, the construction work goes on in Gurgaon. Big lights shine down from towers and dust rises from pits. Scaffolding is being erected, and men and animals, both shaken from their sleep and bleary and insomniac, go around and around carrying concrete, rubble or bricks. A man from one of these construction sites was leading an ass. It wore a bright red saddle, and on this saddle were two metal troughs, filled to the brim with rubble. Behind this ass, two smaller ones, of the same colour, were also saddled with metal troughs full of rubble. These smaller asses were walking slower, and the lead ass stopped often and turned to them, in a way that made you think it was their mother. At once, I knew what was troubling me. I did not want to obey Kusum. She was blackmailing me. I understood why she had sent that letter through the mongoose. If I refused, she would blow the whistle on me, tell Mr. Ashok I hadn't been sending money home. Now, it had been a long time since I had dipped my beak into anything, sir, and the pressure had built up. The girl would be so young, 17 or 18, and you know what girls taste like at that age, like watermelons. Any diseases of body or mind get cured when you penetrate a virgin. These are known facts. And then there was the dowry that Kusum would screw out of the girl's family. All that 24-carat gold, all that cash fresh from the bank. At least some of it I'd keep for myself. All these were sound arguments in favour of marriage. But on the other hand, see, I was like that ass now, and all I would do, if I had children, was teach them to be asses like me and carry rubble around for the rich. I put my hands on the steering wheel, and my fingers tightened into a strangling grip. The way I had rushed to press Mr. Ashok's feet the moment I saw them, even though he hadn't asked me to. Why did I feel that I had to go close to his feet, touch them and press them and make them feel good? Why? Because the desire to be a servant had been bred into me, hammered into my skull, nail after nail, and poured into my blood, the way sewage and industrial poison are poured into Mother Ganja. I had a vision of a pale, stiff foot pushing through a fire. "No," I said. I pulled my feet up onto the seat, got into the lotus position, and said Om over and over again. How long I sat that evening in the car with my eyes closed and legs crossed like the Buddha, I don't know, but the giggling and scratching noise made me open my eyes. All the other drivers had gathered around me. One of them was scratching the glass with his fingernails. Someone had seen me in the lotus position inside the locked car. They were gaping at me as if I was something in a zoo. I scrambled out of the lotus position at once. I put a big grin on my face. I got out of the car to a volley of thumps and blows and shrieks of laughter, all of which I meekly accepted, while murmuring, "Just trying it out. Yoga. They show it on TV all the time, don't they?" The rooster coop was doing its work. Servants have to keep other servants from becoming innovators, experimenters, or entrepreneurs. Yes, that's the sad truth, Mr. Premier. The coop is guarded from the inside. Mr. Premier, you must excuse me. The phone is ringing. I'll be back in a minute. Alas, I'll have to stop this story for a while. It's only 1:32 in the morning, but we'll have to break off here. Something has come up, sir. An emergency. I'll be back. Trust me. The sixth morning. Pardon me, Your Excellency, for the long intermission. It's now 6:20, so I've been gone 5 hours. Unfortunately, there was an incident that threatened to jeopardize the reputation of an outsourcing company I work with. A fairly serious incident, sir. A man has lost his life in this incident. No, don't misunderstand. I had nothing to do with his death, but I'll explain later. Now, excuse me a minute while I turn the fan on. I'm still sweating, sir, and let me sit down on the floor and watch the fan chop up the light of the chandelier. The rest of today's narrative will deal mainly with the sorrowful tale of how I was corrupted from a sweet, innocent village fool into a citified fellow full of debauchery, depravity, and wickedness. All these changes happened in me because they happened first in Mr. Ashok. He returned from America, an innocent man, but life in Delhi corrupted him, and once the master of the Honda City becomes corrupted, how can the driver stay innocent? Now, I thought I knew Mr. Ashok, sir, but that's presumption on the part of any servant. The moment his brother left, he changed. He began wearing a black shirt with the top button open, and changed his perfume. To the mall, sir? Yes. Which mall, sir? The one where Madame used to go. But Mr. Ashok would not take the bait. He was punching the buttons of his cell phone, and he just grunted, Sahara Mall, Balram. That's the one Madame liked going to, sir. Don't keep talking about Madame in every other sentence. I sat outside the mall and wondered what he was doing there. There was a flashing red light on the top floor, and I guessed that it was a disco. Lines of young men and women were standing outside the mall, waiting to go up to that red light. I trembled with fear to see what these city girls were wearing. Mr. Ashok didn't stay long in there, and he came out alone. I breathed out in relief. Back to Buckingham, sir. Not yet. Take me to the Sheraton Hotel. As I drove into the city, I noticed that something was different about the way Delhi looked that night. Had I never before seen how many painted women stood at the sides of the roads? Had I never seen how many men had stopped their cars in the middle of traffic to negotiate a price with these women? I closed my eyes. I shook my head. What's happening to you tonight? At this point, something took place that cleared my confusion, but also proved very embarrassing to me and to Mr. Ashok. I had stopped the car at a traffic signal. A girl began crossing the road in a tight T-shirt, her chest bobbing up and down like 3 kilograms of brinjals in a bag. I glanced at the rearview mirror, and there was Mr. Ashok, his eyes also bobbing up and down. I thought, aha, got you, you rascal. And his eyes shone, for he had seen my eyes, and he was thinking the exact same thing. Aha, got you, you rascal. We had caught each other out. This little rectangular mirror inside the car, Mr. Jabal, has no one ever noticed before how embarrassing it is. How every now and then, when master and driver find each other's eyes in this mirror, it swings open like a door into a changing room, and the two of them have suddenly caught each other naked. I was blushing. Mercifully, the light turned green and I drove on. I swore not to look in the rearview mirror again that night. Now I understood why the city looked so different, why my beak was getting stiff as I was driving. Because he was horny, and inside that sealed car, master and driver had somehow become one body that night. It was with great relief that I drove the Honda into the gate of the Maurya Sheraton Hotel and brought that excruciating trip to an end. Now, Delhi is full of grand hotels. In ring roads and sewage plants, you might have an edge in Beijing, but in pomp and splendour we're second to none in Delhi. We've got the Sheraton, the Imperial, the Taj Palace, Taj Mansingh, the Oberoi, the Intercontinental, and many more. Now, the five-star hotels of Bangalore I know inside out, having spent thousands of rupees eating kebabs of chicken, mutton and beef in their restaurants, and picking up sluts of all nationalities in their bars. But the five stars of Delhi are things of mystery to me. I've been to them all, but I've never stepped past the front door of one. We're not allowed to do that. There's usually a fat guard at the glass door up at the front, a man with a waxed moustache and beard, who wears a ridiculous red circus turban and thinks he's someone important because the American tourists want to have their photo taken with him. If he so much as sees a driver near the hotel, he'll glare. He'll shake a finger like a schoolteacher. That's the driver's fate. Every other servant thinks he can boss over us. There are strict rules at the five stars about where the drivers keep their cars while their masters are inside. Sometimes they put you in a parking spot downstairs. Sometimes in the back. Sometimes up at the front, near the trees. And you sit there and wait for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, yawning and doing nothing, until the guard at the door, the fellow with the turban, mumbles into a microphone saying, "Driver so-and-so, you may come to the glass door with the car. Your master is waiting for you." The drivers were waiting near the parking lot of the hotel, in their usual keychain-swirling, pan-chewing, gossip-mongering, ammonia-releasing circle, crouching and jabbering like monkeys. The driver with the diseased lips was sitting apart from them, engrossed in his magazine. On this week's cover, there was a photo of a woman lying on a bed, her clothes undone. Her lover stood next to her, raising a knife over her head. Murder Weekly. Rupees 450. Exclusive true story. He wanted his master's wife. Love, rape, revenge. "Been thinking about what I said, Country Mouse?" he asked me as he flipped through a story. "About getting your master something he'd like. Hashish, or girls, or golf balls. Genuine golf balls from the U.S. consulate. He's not that kind." The pink lips twisted into a smile. "Want to know a secret? My master likes film actresses. He takes them to a hotel in Jangpura with a big glowing T sign on it and hammers them there." He named three famous Mumbai actresses his master had hammered. "And yet he looks like a goody-goody. Only I know, and I tell you, all the masters are the same. One day you'll believe me. Now come read a story with me." We read like that in total silence. After the third murder story, I went to the side, to a clump of trees, to take an ammonia break. He walked along with me. Our piss hit the bark of the tree just inches apart. "I've got a question for you." "About city girls again?" "No, about what happens to old drivers." "Huh? I mean, what will happen to me a few years from now? Do I make enough money to buy a house and then set up a business of my own?" "Well," he said, "a driver is good till he's 50 or 55. Then the eyes go bad and they kick you out, right? That's 30 years from now, Country Mouse. If you save from today, you'll make enough to buy a small home in some slum. If you've been a bit smarter and made a little extra on the side, then you'll have enough to put your son in a good school. He can learn English. He can go to university. That's the best-case scenario. A house in a slum, a kid in college." "Best case." "Well, on the other hand, you can get typhoid from bad water. Boss sacks you for no reason. You get into an accident. Plenty of worst-case scenarios." I was still pissing, but he put a hand on me. "There's something I've got to ask you, Country Mouse. Are you all right?" I looked at him sideways. "I'm fine. Why do you ask?" "I'm sorry to tell you this, but some of the drivers are talking about it openly. You sit by yourself in your master's car the whole time. You talk to yourself. You know what you need? A woman. Have you seen the slum behind the malls? They're not bad looking. Nice and plump.
Some of us go there once a week. You can come too.
Driver Balram, where are you?
It was the call from the microphone at the gate of the hotel. Mr. Turban was at the microphone, speaking in the most pompous, stern voice possible.
Driver Balram, report at once to the door. No delay, your master wants you.
I zipped up and ran, wiping my wet fingers on the back of my pants. Mr. Ashok was walking out of the hotel with his hands around a girl when I brought the car up to the gate. She was a slant-eyed one with yellow skin, a foreigner, a Nepali, not even of his caste or background. She sniffed about the seats that I had polished, and jumped on them. Mr. Ashok put his hands on the girl's bare shoulders. I took my eyes away from the mirror. I have never approved of debauchery inside cars, Mr. Jabal. But I could smell the mingling of their perfumes. I knew exactly what was going on behind me. I thought he would ask me to drive him home now, but no. The carnival of fun just went on and on. He wanted to go to PVR Circuit. Now, PVR Circuit is the scene of a big cinema, which shows 10 or 12 cinemas at the same time, and charges over 150 rupees per cinema. Yes, that's right. 150 rupees. That's not all. You've also got plenty of places to drink beer, dance, pick up girls, that sort of thing. A small bit of America in India. Beyond the last shining shop begins the second PVR. Every big market in Delhi is two markets in one. There is always a smaller, grimier mirror image of the real market, tucked somewhere into a by-lane. This is the market for the servants. I crossed over to the second PVR, a line of stinking restaurants, tea stalls, and giant frying pans where bread was toasted in oil. The men who work in the cinemas and who sweep them clean come here to eat. The beggars have their homes here. I bought a tea and a potato vada and sat under a banyan tree to eat.
Brother, give me 3 rupees.
An old woman, looking lean and miserable, with her hands stretched out.
I'm not one of the rich, mother. Go to that side and ask them.
Brother.
Let me eat, all right. Just leave me alone.
She went. A knife grinder came and set up his stall right next to my tree. Holding 2 knives in his hand, he sat on his machine. It was one of the foot-pedaled whetstones, and began peddling. Sparks began buzzing a couple of inches away from me.
Brother, do you have to do your work here? Don't you see a human being is trying to eat?
He stopped peddling, blinked, then put the blades to the whizzing whetstone again, as if he hadn't heard a word I'd said. I threw the potato vada at his feet.
How stupid can you people get?
The old beggar woman made the crossing with me, into the other PVR. She hitched up her sari, took a breath, and then began her routine.
Sister, just give me 3 rupees. I haven't eaten since morning.
A giant pile of old books lay in the center of the market, arranged in a large hollow square, like the mandala made at weddings to hold the sacred fire. A small man sat cross-legged on a stack of magazines in the center of the square of books, like the priest in charge of this mandala of print. The books drew me toward them like a big magnet, but as soon as he saw me, the man sitting on the magazine snapped,
"All the books are in English."
"So?"
"Do you read English?" he barked.
"Do you read English?" I retorted. There, that did it. Until then his tone of talking to me had been servant to servant. Now it became man to man. He stopped and looked me over from top to bottom.
"No,"
he said, breaking into a smile, as if he appreciated my balls.
"So how do you sell the books without knowing English?"
"I know which book is what from the cover," he said.
"I know this one is Harry Potter."
He showed it to me.
"I know this one is James Hadley Chase."
He picked it up. "This is Khalil Gibran. This is Adolf Hitler, Desmond Bagley, The Joy of Sex. One time the publisher changed the Hitler cover so it looked like Harry Potter, and life was hell for a week after that. I just want to stand around the books. I had a book once, when I was a boy."
"Suit yourself."
So I stood around that big square of books. Standing around books, even books in a foreign language, you feel a kind of electricity buzzing up toward you, Your Excellency. It just happens, the way you get erect around girls wearing tight jeans. Except here what happens is that your brain starts to hum. 4,700 rupees in that brown envelope under my bed. Odd sum of money, wasn't it? There was a mystery to be solved here. Let's see. Maybe she started off giving me 5,000, and then being cheap, like all rich people are. Remember how the mongoose made me get down on my knees for that 1 rupee coin? Deducted 300. That's not how the rich think, you moron. Haven't you learned yet? She must have taken out 10,000 at first, then cut it in half, and kept half for herself, then taken out another 100 rupees, another 100, and another 100. That's how cheap they are. So that means they really owe you 10,000. But if she thought she owed you 10,000, then what she truly owed you was, what, 10 times more? No, 100 times more. The small man, putting down the newspaper he was reading, turned to me from inside his mandala of books. "What did you say?" he shouted. "Nothing." He shouted again. "Hey, what do you do?" I grabbed an imaginary wheel and turned it 180 degrees. "Ah, I should have known. Drivers are smart men. They hear a lot of interesting things, right?" "Other drivers might. I go deaf inside the car." "Sure, sure. Tell me, you must know English. Some of what they talk must stick to you." "I told you. I don't listen. How can it stick?" "What does this word in the newspaper mean? Privacy." I told him, and he smiled gratefully. "We had just started the English alphabet when I got taken out of school by my family." So he was another of the half-baked, my caste. "Hey!" he shouted again. "Want to read some of this?" He held up a magazine with an American woman on the cover, the kind that rich boys like to buy. "It's good stuff." I flicked through the magazine. He was right. It was good stuff. "How much does this magazine sell for?" 60 rupees. Would you believe that? 60 rupees for a used magazine. And there's a fellow in Khan Market who sells magazines from England that cost 508 rupees each. Would you believe that? I raised my head to the sky and whistled. "Amazing how much money they have," I said aloud, yet as if talking to myself. "And yet they treat us like animals." It was as if I had said something to disturb him, because he lowered and raised his paper a couple of times. Then he came to the very edge of the mandala, and partially hiding his face with the paper, whispered something. I cupped a hand around my ear. "Say that again?" He looked around and said, a bit louder this time, "It won't last forever, though, the current situation." "Why not?" I moved toward the mandala. "Have you heard about the Naxals?" he whispered over the books. "They've got guns. They've got a whole army. They're getting stronger by the day." "Really?" "Just read the papers. The Chinese want a civil war in India, see? Chinese bombs are coming to Burma and into Bangladesh and then into Calcutta. They go down south into Andhra Pradesh and up into the darkness. When the time is right, all of India will..." He opened his palms. We talked like this for a while, but then our friendship ended, as all servant-servant friendships must, with our masters bellowing for us. A gang of rich kids wanted to be shown a smutty American magazine, and Mr. Ashok came walking out of a bar, staggering, stinking of liquor. The Nepali girl was with him. On the way back, the two of them were talking at the top of their voices, and then the petting and kissing began. My God, and he a man who was still lawfully married to another woman. I was so furious that I drove right through 4 red lights and almost smashed into an ox cart that was going down the road with a load of kerosene cans, but they never noticed. "Good night, Balram," Mr. Ashok shouted as he got out, hand in hand with her. "Good night, Balram," she shouted. They ran into the apartment and took turns jabbing the call button for the elevator. When I got to my room, I searched under the bed. It was still there, the Maharaja tunic that he had given me, the turban and dark glasses, too. I drove the car out of the apartment block, dressed like a Maharaja with the dark glasses on. No idea where I was going. I just drove around the malls. Each time I saw a pretty girl, I hooted the horn at her and her friends. I played his music. I ran his AC at full blast. I drove back to the building, took the car down into the garage, folded the dark glasses into my pocket, and took off the tunic. I spat over the seats of the Honda City and wiped them clean. The next morning, he didn't come down or call me up to his room. I took the elevator and stood near the door. I was feeling guilty about what I'd done the previous night. I wondered if I should make a full confession. I reached for the bell a few times and then sighed and gave up. After a while, there were soft noises from inside. I put my ear to the wood and listened. But I have changed. Don't keep apologizing. I had more fun last evening than in 4 years of marriage. When you left for New York, I thought I'd never see you again. And now I have. That's the main thing for me. I turned away from the door and slapped my fist into my forehead. My guilt was growing by the minute. She was his old lover, you fool, not some pickup. Of course, he would never go for a slut. I had always known that he was a good man, a cut above me. I pinched my left palm as punishment and put my ear to the door again. The phone began to ring from inside. Silence for a while, and then he said, "That's Puddles, and that's Cuddles. You remember them, don't you? They always bark for me. Here, take the phone. Listen." "Bad news?" Her voice, after a few minutes. "You look upset." "I have to go see a cabinet minister. I hate doing that. They're all so slimy. The business I'm in, it's a bad one. I wish I were doing something else, something clean, like outsourcing. Every day I wish it." "Why don't you do something else, then? It was the same when they told you not to marry me. You couldn't say no then, either." "It's not that simple, Uma. They're my father and brother." "I wonder if you have changed, Ashok. The first call from Dhanbad and you're back to your old self. Look, let's not fight again. I'll send you back in the car now." "Oh, no. I'm not going back with your driver. I know his kind, the village kind. They think that any unmarried woman they see is a whore, and he probably thinks I'm a Nepali because of my eyes. You know what that means for him. I'll go back on my own." "This fellow is all right. He's part of the family." "You shouldn't be so trusting, Ashok. Delhi drivers are all rotten. They sell drugs and prostitutes, and God knows what else." "Not this one. He's stupid as hell, but he is honest. He'll drive you back." "No, Ashok. I'll get a taxi. I'll call you in the evening." I realized that she was edging toward the door, and I turned and tiptoed away. There was no word from him until evening, and then he came down for the car. He made me go from one bank to another bank. Sitting in the driver's seat, I watched through the corner of my eye. He was collecting money from the automatic cash machines, 4 different ones. Then he said, "Balram, go to the city. You know the big house that's on the Ashoka Road, where we went with Mukesh Siyar once?" "Yes, sir, I remember. They've got 2 big Alsatian guard dogs, sir." "Exactly. Your memory's good, Balram." I saw in the spy mirror that Mr. Ashok was pressing the buttons of his cell phone as I drove, probably telling the minister's servant that he was coming with the cash. So now I understood at last what work my master was doing as I drove him through Delhi. "I'll be back in 20 minutes, Balram," Mr. Ashok said when we got to the minister's bungalow. He stepped out with the red bag and slammed the door. A security guard with a rifle sat in a metal booth over the red wall of the minister's house, watching me carefully. The 2 Alsatian dogs roaming the compound barked now and then. It was the hour of sunset. The birds of the city began to make a ruckus as they flew home. "Now, Delhi, Mr. Premier, is a big city, but there are wild places in it, big parks, protected forests, stretches of wasteland, and things can suddenly come out of these wild places. As I was watching the red wall of the minister's house, a peacock flew up over the guard's booth and perched there. For an instant its deep blue neck and its long tail turned golden in the setting sunlight. Then it vanished. In a little while it was night. The dogs began barking. The gate opened. Mr. Ashok came out of the minister's house with a fat man, the same man who had come out that day from the president's house. I guessed that he was the minister's assistant. They stopped in front of the car and talked. The fat man shook hands with Mr. Ashok, who was clearly eager to leave him. But ah, it isn't so easy to let go of a politician, or even a politician's sidekick. I got out of the car, pretending to check the tires, and moved into eavesdropping distance.
Don't worry, Ashok. I'll make sure the minister gives your father a call tomorrow.
Thank you. My family appreciates your help.
What are you doing after this?
Nothing. Just going home to Gurgaon.
A young man like you going home this early? Let's have some fun.
Don't you have to work on the elections?
The elections? All wrapped up. It's a landslide. The minister said so this morning. Elections, my friend, can be managed in India. It's not like in America.
Brushing aside Mr. Ashok's protests, the fat man forced his way into the car. We had just started down the road when he said,
Ashok, let me have a whiskey.
Here, in the car. I don't have any. The fat man seemed astonished.
Everyone has whiskey in their car in Delhi, Ashok. Didn't you know this?
He told me to go back to the minister's bungalow. He went inside and came back with a pair of glasses and a bottle. He slammed the door, breathed out, and said,
Now this car is fully equipped.
Mr. Ashok took the bottle and got ready to pour the fat man a glass, when he smacked his lips in annoyance.
Not you, you fool. The driver. He is the one who pours the drinks.
I turned around at once and turned myself into a barman.
This driver is very talented, the fat man said. Sometimes they make a mess of pouring a drink.
You'd never guess that his caste was a teetotaling one, would you?
I tightened the cap on the bottle and left it next to the gearbox.
I heard the clinking of glasses behind me and two voices saying, Cheers.
Let's go, the minister's sidekick said. Let's go to the Sheraton, driver. There's a good restaurant down in the basement there, Ashok. Quiet place. We'll have some fun there.
I turned the ignition key and took the dark egg of the Honda City down the streets of New Delhi.
A man's car is a man's palace. I can't believe you've never done this.
Well, you'd never try it in America, would you?
That's the whole advantage of being in Delhi, dear boy.
The fat man slapped Mr. Ashok's thigh.
He sipped and said, What's your situation, Ashok?
Coal trading these days. People think it's only technology that's booming.
But coal? The media pays no attention to coal, does it?
The Chinese are consuming coal like crazy, and the price is going up everywhere. Millionaires are being made left, right, and center.
Sure, sure, the fat man said. The China effect.
He sniffed his glass. But that's not what we in Delhi mean when we say situation, dear boy. The minister's sidekick smiled.
Basically, what I'm asking is, who services you? Down there.
He pointed at a part of Mr. Ashok's body that he had no business pointing at. I am separated, going through a divorce.
I'm sorry to hear that, the fat man said. Marriage is a good institution. Everything's coming apart in this country. Families, marriages, everything.
He sipped some more whiskey and said, Tell me, Ashok. Do you think there will be a civil war in this country?
Why do you say that?
4 days ago, I was in a court in Ghaziabad. The judge gave an order that the lawyers didn't like, and they simply refused to accept his order. They went mad. They dragged the judge down and beat him in his own court. The matter was not reported in the press, but I saw it with my own eyes. If people start beating the judges in their own courtrooms, then what is the future for our country?
Something icy cold touched my neck. The fat man was rubbing me with his glass. Another drink, driver.
Yes, sir. Have you ever seen this trick, Your Excellency? A man steering the car with one hand, and picking up a whiskey bottle with the other hand, hauling it over his shoulder, then pouring it into a glass, even as the car is moving without spilling a drop. The skills required of an Indian driver. Not only does he have to have perfect reflexes, night vision, and infinite patience, he also has to be the consummate barman. Would you like some more, sir? I glanced at the minister's sidekick, at the fat, corrupt folds of flesh under his chin, then glanced at the road to make sure I wasn't driving into anything. Pour one for your master now. No, I don't drink much, really. I'm fine.
Don't be silly, Ashok, I insist. Fellow, pour one for your master.
So I had to turn and do the amazing one hand on the wheel, one hand with the whiskey bottle trick all over again. The fat man went quiet after the second drink. He wiped his lips.
When you were in America, you must have had a lot of women. I mean, the local women.
No.
No? What does that mean?
I was faithful to Pinky, my wife, the whole time.
My, you were faithful.
What an idea. Faithfully married. No wonder it ended in divorce.
Have you never had a white woman?
I told you.
God, why is it always the wrong kind of Indian who goes abroad? Listen, do you want one now? A European girl?
Now?
Now,
he said. A female from Russia. She looks just like that American actress. He mentioned the name. Want to do it?
A whore.
The fat man smiled.
A friend. A magical friend. Want to do it?
No, thanks. I'm seeing someone. I just met someone I knew along... The fat man took out his cell phone and punched some numbers. The light of the phone made a blue halo on his face.
She's there right now. Let's go see her. She's a stunner, I tell you. Just like that American actress.
Do you have 30,000 on you?
No, listen, I'm seeing someone. I'm not... No problem. I'll pay now. You can pay later. Just put it into the next envelope you give the minister.
He put his hand on Mr. Ashok's hand and winked, then leaned over and gave instructions to me. I looked at Mr. Ashok in the rearview mirror as hard as I could.
A whore? That's for people like me, sir. Are you sure you want this?
I wish I could have told him this openly. But who was I? Just the driver. I took orders from the fat man. Mr. Ashok said nothing. Just sat there sucking his whiskey like a boy with a soda. Maybe he thought it was a joke. Or maybe he was too frightened of the fat man to say no. But I will defend his honor to my deathbed. They corrupted him. The fat man made me drive to a place in Greater Kailash, another housing colony where people of quality live in Delhi. Touching my neck with his icy glass when I had to make a turn, he guided me to the place. It was as large as a small palace, with big white columns of marble up the front. From the amount of garbage thrown outside the walls of the house, you knew that rich people lived here. The fat man held open the car door as he spoke into a phone. 5 minutes later, he slammed the door shut. I began sneezing. A weird perfume had filled the back of the car.
Stop that sneezing and drive us toward Jangpura, son.
Sorry, sir. The fat man smiled. He turned to the girl who had got into the car and said, Speak to my friend Ashok in Hindi, please. I looked into the rearview mirror and caught my first glimpse of this girl. It's true. She did look like an actress I had seen somewhere or other. The name of the actress, though, I don't know. It's only when I came to Bangalore and mastered the use of the Internet, in just 2 quick sessions, mind you, that I found her photo and name on Google. Kim Basinger. That was the name the fat man had mentioned, and it was true. The girl who got in with the fat man did look exactly like Kim Basinger. She was tall and beautiful. But the most remarkable thing about her was her hair, golden and glossy, just like in the shampoo advertisements. How are you, Ashok? She said it in perfect Hindi. She put her hand out and took Mr. Ashok's hand. The minister's assistant chuckled.
There, India has progressed, hasn't it? She's speaking in Hindi.
He slapped her on the thigh.
Your Hindi has improved, dear.
Mr. Ashok leaned back to speak to the fat man over her shoulder.
Is she Russian?
Ask her. Don't ask me, Ashok. Don't be shy. She's a friend.
Ukrainian, she said in her accented Hindi. I am a Ukrainian student in India.
I thought I would have to remember this place, Ukraine, and one day I would have to go there.
Ashok,
the fat man said,
go on, touch her hair. It's real. Don't be scared. She's a friend.
He chuckled.
See, didn't hurt,
did it, Ashok? Say something in Hindi to Mr. Ashok, dear. He's still frightened of you.
You're a handsome man, she said. Don't be frightened of me.
Driver, the fat man leaned forward and touched me with his gold glass again.
Are we near Jangpura?
Yes, sir. When you go down the Masjid Road, you'll see a hotel with a big neon T sign on it. Take us there. I got them there in 10 minutes. You couldn't miss the hotel. The big T sign on it glowed like a lantern in the dark. Taking the golden-haired woman with him, the fat man went up to the hotel reception, where the manager greeted him warmly. Mr. Ashok walked behind them and kept looking from side to side, like a guilty little boy about to do something very bad. Half an hour passed. I was outside, my hands on the wheels the whole time. I punched the little ogre. I began to gnaw at the wheel. I kept hoping he'd come running out, arms flailing and screaming, Balram, I was on the verge of making a mistake. Save me, let's drive away at once. An hour later, Mr. Ashok came out of the hotel, alone and looking ill. The meeting's over, Balram, he said, letting his head fall back on the seat. Let's go home. I didn't start the car for a second. I kept my finger on the ignition key.
Balram, let's go home, I said.
Yes, sir. When we got back to Gurgaon, he staggered out toward the elevator. I did not leave the car. I let 5 minutes pass and then drove back to Jangpura, straight to the hotel with the T on it. I parked in a corner and watched the door of the hotel. I wanted her to come out. A rickshaw puller drove up next to me, a small, unshaven, stick-thin man who looked dead tired as he wiped his face and legs clean with a rag and went to sleep on the ground. On the seat of his rickshaw was a white advertising sticker. Is excess weight a problem for you? Call Jimmy Singh at Metro Gym, 9811-799-289. The mascot of the gym, an American with enormous white muscles, smiled at me from above the slogan. The rickshaw puller's snoring filled the air. Someone in the hotel must have seen me. After a while, the door opened. A policeman came out, peered at me, and then began walking down the steps. I turned the key. I took the car back to Gurgaon. Now, I've driven around Bangalore at night, too, but I never get that feeling here that I did in Delhi. The feeling that if something is burning inside me as I drive, the city will know about it. She will burn with the same thing. My heart was bitter that night. The city knew this, and under the dim orange glow cast everywhere by the weak street lamps, she was bitter. Speak to me of civil war, I told Delhi. I will, she said. An overturned flower urn on a traffic island in the middle of a road. Next to it, three men sit with open mouths. An older man with a beard and white turban is talking to them with a finger upraised. Cars drive by him with their dazzling headlights, and the noise drowns out his words. He looks like a prophet in the middle of the city, unnoticed except by his three apostles. They will become his three generals. That overturned flower urn is a symbol of some kind. Speak to me of blood on the streets, I told Delhi. I will, she said. I saw other men discussing and talking and reading in the night, alone or in clusters around the street lamps. By the dim lights of Delhi, I saw hundreds that night, under trees, shrines, intersections, on benches, squinting at newspapers, holy books, journals, Communist Party pamphlets. What were they reading about? What were they talking about? But what else? of the end of the world. And if there is blood on these streets, I asked the city, do you promise that he'll be the first to go, that man with the fat folds under his neck? A beggar, sitting by the side of the road, a nearly naked man coated with grime, and with wild unkempt hair in long coils like snakes, looked into my eyes. Promise. Coloured pieces of glass have been embedded into the boundary wall of Buckingham Towers B block to keep robbers out. When the headlights hit them, the shards glow, and the wall turns into a technicoloured glass-spined monster. The gatekeeper stared at me as I drove in. I saw rupee notes shining in his eyes. This was the second time he had seen me going out and returning on my own. In the parking lot, I got out of the driver's seat and carefully closed the door. I opened the passenger's door and went inside, and passed my hand along the leather. I passed my hands from one side of the leather seats to the other three times, and then I found what I was looking for. I held it up to the light. A strand of golden hair. I've got it in my desk to this day.